Hi guys, welcome to the 69th episode of the Vassals of Kingsgrave epic Lunia's reread of George R. R. Martin's amazing A Song of Ice and Fire.
You were laughing the whole way through that.
My name's Bina 007. I'm going to be your host for this evening's proceedings. I am joined by our Canadian correspondent, Stephen.
Hi, this is Stephen S. Jaley on the forums.
Awesome, S. Jaley. I'm so pleased you could join us. I'm also joined by two people that I had the immense pleasure of meeting in real life in Chicago last month. The first is Paul.
Hey, this is Paul, Sir General on the forums.
Fantastic. And the second is Xander.
Yo, Xander, Lord Baron on the forums.
Oh man, we had so much fun. And then the last but not least person on this podcast is my fellow Cockney Moot participant, Noah.
Hello, hello. Pops 88 on the forums, Noah in real life.
Call Blunt Me Governor Strikerlight.
I was about to say, I think that was like the most British greeting I think I've ever heard.
Fantastico. Okay, so this episode is going to potentially spoil anything that happens in A Song of Ice and Fire. We'll flag up anything that's tee-wowie. I'm not sure there will be in this episode. It won't spoil the show. So, we ended the last episode with John 1 from A Dance with Dragons, which took place on the 17th of February, 300 AL. In this episode, we're going to cover Bran 1 from A Dance with Dragons, Sam 1 from A Feast for Crows, and John 2 from A Dance with Dragons. So those last two happen basically pretty much simultaneously, so that's going to be really interesting. These events take place on the 18th and then the 20th of February, 300 AL, and we are going to kick off with the Bran 1 chapter, the first chapter from Dance, and it's Pops 88 with a summary. Gallantly stepping in from a sick Hannah who can't be with us today.
Yeah, get well soon, Hannah.
Get well soon.
Your presence is missed.
Bloody hell, if she's not well by the time this comes out, she's got real problems.
The sentiment is still there.
Indeed.
All right. So the chapter opens with Bran's thoughts echoing the readers regarding winds. How much longer? The group continue north of the north, riding on the elk, except poor Hodor, who walks in the snow. Jojen is becoming weaker by the day, Mira is pissed off, Cold Hands has cold hands, and Hodor is being increasingly mentally violated by Bran. Bran has been walking more frequently into him, but especially Summer, and he gets the feeling that the two are becoming one. We also get a string of delightful descriptions of everyone's frozen snot, which continues through the chapter. They are followed by a murder of Blood Raven's ravens, who scout for Cold Hands, letting him know of the men following them. He goes off to confront them, and the group immediately bitch about him. Have you seen those rags he wears? I bet he's hideous under that scarf. Bran uses Summer to find the village Cold Hands described.
Okay, while I'm laughing, I need to interject, because when you said two become one, I got this earworm of the Spice Girls song, Two Become One. Damn you. Damn you, Noah.
Glad that I wasn't the only one.
That was deliberately put in there, guys. We all like a bit of cheesy Britpop.
I'm going to have to now sort of inflict that upon all the listeners before we get to the after show. You two shall share my pain.
Absolutely. Bran uses Summer to find the village Cold Hands described and then slips back into his skin to hunt. Bran and Sam find the Night's Watch meat, but a pack of wolves have also made the discovery. Bran and Sam fuck them up, followed by humiliation and a cheeky bum sniff. Bran returns to his body to find a fire, Cold Hands, and meat he found. He interrogates Cold Hands on the dead Night's Watchman and his appearance, confirming that he's a reanimated corpse. Before a discussion breaks out, Jojen states they would die if they turned back to the wall. We go with Bran's monster or we die. And that's it.
Well, that was cheery.
I tried to make it as cheery as possible. Bum sniffs and frozen snot. Come on, guys.
Spice Girls, it was all there.
Oh, yeah.
Do you guys enjoy the Bran chapters? I found this quite hard. Like, some chapters on a reread, like the John, I was just, like, so into. This I found, like, really tough.
I know you always think that Bran is, like, the Omen of Game of Thrones. So I did pull up a few quotes that I'll, for you later about monsters and Bran Stark. But no, I quite like Bran. It's like, I don't know, you know, it's kind of like a kid walking through hell but doesn't really see it as hell. Just kind of, you know, ooh, it's snowing and oh, look, let's eat and kill. And
but
ooh, there's
becoming,
an old man stuck in a tree.
It's increasingly slippery, and I find the childishness a little bit of a cop-out. There's a really interesting line where George says, kind of Bran, that's what Bran tells himself when he says that Hodor is getting used to the fact that Bran's walking into
Yeah.
him. And it's like, you know what you're doing is fundamentally a bit dodge, and you're doing it anyway. And I know you're a kid, but you can't, you know this, right, Bran? You know this. You know, at this point, he's how old? He's 10.
Man grown.
He's man grown. Stop dicking about with Hodor. It's just not, it's not right.
I guess it really just kind of shows how, like, there is, like, kind of, like, a dark side to a child with this kind of just power over things, and how that could be so open for abuse, because not only is he, like, so, like, he's like, oh, yeah, Odor's okay with me warging into him now, because he's getting used to it. Well, that's not the point. You shouldn't be forcing Hodor to get used to anything, but, and then, of course, we see him kind of building an addiction to warging into summer and just kind of hunting and being kind of a wild animal for a time.
Mm.
Mm.
I think it's he's, you know, when he left Winterfell, he was a kid. He was, I mean, it was what, a year ago now ish.
Yeah.
And he's not really had any, you know, Maester Luwin was the last sort of parental figure in his life. So he still is that age, I suppose. I'm more interested to see Rickon in like 3 years' time when he's like a 12-year-old with the mind of a 4-year-old.
I think he'll just be at one with a direwolf and you won't be able to tell them apart.
Maybe.
I don't think he'll have had the self-discipline to retain his identity as human. And I wonder,
wild red-haired kid.
Yeah, I just want, but I do wonder what happens to you qua human. I mean, if you're constantly walking, if you forget to come out and just eat as a human, I could see a really easy kind of way forward whereby Rickon just walks and walks and eventually forgets to come out and just dies. God, that's dark. I mean, do you guys think Rickon makes it?
I mean, I think if Rickon does make it, he's going to be the new wild wolf.
You know, there's a small literary theory about Rickon.
Go for it.
A shaggy dog story is a story that goes on and doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, I knew that's where you were going with that.
Right. So I don't know if he's purposely a red herring. I don't think so. I think he's coming back and he'll probably
King
House Stark is refounded on.
I think maybe originally that was his, you know, idea with the just writing a trilogy. So he thought it'd be funny to throw that in. But like now it's become like, where Rickon actually does become an asset to the story without the 5-year gap or it being condensed to a trilogy series rather than a saga.
I just feel that if Rickon does, like, return, it's either going to be as a completely kind of wild child who is almost basically half wolf the time, or he's going to be almost entirely wildling because Osha has been maybe, like, make it just basically teaching him to be more of a wildling because that's what's required at the time.
So can we take that part apart a little bit? Like, I could understand when people say Rickon's going to be wild because he bonded with his wolf too young, but isn't it a bit of a stretch to say he's going to be like a savage because he's been with the Skagosi or whatever, because Martin has spent at least 4 books showing that the wildlings are a complex and nuanced culture? And
well, no, I don't mean like as a savage. I mean just as a wildling. Culturally, he's going to be like, I don't want to be a lord. What the fuck is a lord? That sounds like bullshit. I feel like he'll be more free-spirited in the way, like the wildling culture will be
more democratic, kind of, maybe.
Well,
maybe
certainly he'll have more democratic, but I feel like that would be a detriment because then if he comes back to the Seven Kingdoms, everyone's going to be like, what, democracy? Get the fuck out of here.
I don't think the wildlings don't practice democracy. They don't vote for their leader. They practice like a system of voluntary loyalty. So if Rickon's destiny has become the Stark in Winterfell, and basically he finds ways to win over the lords of the North to create like a stronger, more unified kingdom, I think that actually sounds very promising. And there's also historical precedent that the Starks might have more wildling in them than they care to admit in their history.
I don't know. I think it's just because in my head, I'm consistently thinking Sansa is going to be the one to ensure, like, Stark, like, continuation in the North.
I suppose this all depends on what you think is going to happen with Davos and Grand Northern conspiracies.
That is a big question.
But I suspect Rickon just may get lost to us in the same way that Benjen is. And I wouldn't mind that. I don't think everyone has to have a neatly tied up story by any means.
I think we'll see him again, though. I mean, Davos is going there. If we don't see Rickon, it's kind of like...
What was the point?
Almost like, yeah, clawing him back into the story. I mean, because I'd love to see me some some more Melisandre Davos beef argument.
Yes.
Because those scenes are fucking brilliant.
No doubt. No doubt.
And I also doubt that he would write Davos searching for Rickon as another Brienne looking for Sansa arc.
One can only hope.
Well, Skagos isn't that big of an island. You should be able to try to find him.
Yeah, it's a bit smaller than the Riverlands.
Yeah,
and this one has a giant black wolf with him, so...
What would Davos say? I'm looking for my younger brother of 3 years old. Might be five. Massive wolf. Can't miss him.
Auburn hair.
Yeah.
Wouldn't he just say son, then?
Or grandson.
Davos. Well,
maybe he's not that smart.
The father remarried several times. That's a story.
Yeah, he's my father-in-law, technically.
Anyone out there with any crazy Cold Hands theories beyond the usual?
Oh, I was gonna look up options, but I think on a cursory glance they were all really boring, like Benjen or more Benjen.
Brynden Rivers, the Night's King, blah blah blah. Waymar Royce.
I would like the idea that that Bloodraven has kind of like gained a little bit of the other's powers. I mean, obviously we don't know how he's got his and blah blah blah, but however he's acquired his own powers, he's learned a little bit of the other's powers, and we're seeing Bloodraven. So all these words coming out of Coldhand's mouth are Bloodravens.
I think it might be more appealing to me if Coldhands is just a regular person. I don't always like the idea that everyone is someone and there's this vast network in place.
I agree.
Not everyone needs to be a Skywalker.
Oh, you must have loved The Last Jedi. I was just going to say.
Let's not get into that, Noah. But what I will say is that one of the interesting things about Cold Hands is it shows kind of that the magic that makes the whites and that the others use are not necessarily evil by nature. That this stuff can be used in a far less destructive way.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, it would fit with George's Grey story.
I like the idea that magic is of itself just a weapon that can be used for good or evil. But I know that we're encouraged in these books to think of a certain type of magic as of its nature dark, right? So blood magic is somehow intrinsically bad. And I guess I'd always thought of the sort of the white's magic as somehow on that scale. So that's kind of interesting that you think.
I think the magic in the series is supposed to be viewed as a tool. And maybe the origins of which are troubling, but nonetheless, you can bend the magic to do different things. And I think it often has really negative and dire consequences, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way.
Okay, so you think that Cold Hands might be working for Bloodraven? Is that the idea? Do you think Bloodraven means well? Because I tend to think maybe he doesn't mean well.
That's really hard.
I would say, I mean, just based on what we see of Brynden Rivers in the Duncan Egg stories, that he means well in the greater good sort of well. And if people die and get in his way, and you know, as long as he achieves that goal, it doesn't matter who gets in his way. Almost Tywin-esque.
And his goal is what? Just to preserve the land south of the Wall from evil?
Well, to prevent the Long Night. I mean, I think we can all say that's a pretty worthy goal.
And then what does he want? He doesn't give a shit if Bran becomes Tree Bran, right?
No, he doesn't care about Bran. I mean, he's going to use Bran, and if he loses his identity and his soul, then that's just a price of war.
Collateral damage.
That's it, collateral damage, yeah.
And therefore it makes sense that Coldhands is just some long dead ranger who just happens to be a body he can animate to guide them towards him, I guess.
It was probably like one of his pals from when he was Lord Commander.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just some dude from back then.
Yeah, I hope we never know. I think it's nice to have a few mysteries.
I do like the idea of just the mysterious kind of badass character. Who's like, we're being followed. Wait here, I'll deal with it. And he just comes back. It's like, okay, they're gone.
I sort of feel that in real life, he would be Sir Christopher Lee.
Ooh, good shout.
I just feel that is how Christopher Lee would operate if he were a nice zombie.
I would actually more so compare him to the Russian from Heart of Darkness. Kind of leading Bran towards Ooh, what is the other guy's name?
Oh, Kurtz.
Yes, Kurtz.
That is a great comparison.
Yeah, Blood Raven would be the Kurtz of the story, whereas the Russian would be the role of Cold Hands. So just a random person that's there to kind of just guide them on the journey.
I love the smell of dragon fire in the morning.
Great.
Other stuff in the chapter?
Yeah, you asked about brand chapters in general. I think they get a little bit of a bum rap. I'm not saying they're my favorites or they're great in any way, but a lot of the neat little details of the stories come out from his chapters. I know it was a while ago, but I'm thinking of the Rat King, the Mystery Knight story. Even the stuff with the warging is kind of cool, like just filling in the world as it goes. But the actual, we're walking through snow and it's very cold is not terribly interesting all on its own.
I'd rather read about food than the not having of food.
Oh, God, yeah. I made a note of that in this chapter, what was it? They'd been eating acorns for 3 days. And before that, their food ran out 10 days ago. So they were just eating frozen fish that Mira was getting.
Yeah, it's pretty savage. When you think that at the same time, I'm kind of reading or editing just slightly previous episodes of the reread where we're talking about, just lavish feasts in King's Landing at various weddings. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Anything else from anyone else?
Yeah, I've got a couple of things if no one else has anything. Does Bran have heightened senses from warging too much into summer?
Oh, what, you think he retains the heightened senses when he's back as a boy?
Yeah, well, there's a few little things, he could still smell what summer smells. It wasn't as acute, but it was still pretty strong for a boy.
Or do you think that sort of phantom limb stuff?
Yeah, maybe, actually.
He loves walking so much that when he's a human, he imagines himself having those powers that he so craves, but he doesn't really.
I think I would agree with Noah, because in the John chapter I'm covering later, he actually makes a comment about how when he's in ghosts, he can smell things and taste things better, and ghosts is more alive than he is. So, in contrast to Bran, in Bran's own body, being able to smell things better or kind of perceive things more astutely than you would normally, I think that's kind of a nice little contrast that the whole John denying his warging abilities, whereas Bran embraces it.
Yeah, but I guess that's kind of a bit my point. Maybe Bran has been warging proportionately more and more intensely, and therefore it's kind of it is harder for him to give it up or to admit that he doesn't have those powers in the real world. And he's younger, so kind of keeping those identities separate is harder for him, whereas for John it's easier. The warging is this discreet thing that he does on occasion.
I view it more as a sense memory thing, you were saying, the memory of the smell is still fresh in his mind, so it kind of plays out. Or if he just got out of Hordor and he returned to his body and he felt his legs were tingling or something like that, I would just assume that's his mind sending signals to his body that can't respond to them because it had just been sending signals to a body that could respond to them.
Yeah, that's how I see it. It's echoes in his mind of what was happening previously.
Yeah, because I think very much his body is his body, and it's only his mind that can experience anything else.
I mean, I think until we see Rickon, we don't have another example to really compare with, and no, it's just yet another reason why I really want to see Rickon.
Yeah, I like the idea of just him one day waking up and just doing a teen wolf or something, just oh my god, I'm so hairy and I'm 10, fuck.
That was a great film.
we do have Arya's stuff with the cat, but that might be a little bit confusing because, she's sneaking around like a cat while she's using a cat to see. What is metaphor and what is being taken more literally there? Shrug.
Yeah.
Did Rob ever walk?
Not knowingly, I don't think. I think, the only reason why I ask it about Bran is because he's obviously done it the most often. I mean, I guess the only one you can compare it to is Varamyr. And again, my shocking lack of knowledge here. I don't recall if Varamyr was inclined, if he could smell better once he was back in his human body or anything like that.
I wonder if Varamyr it was less of a transfer because he would walk into different animals, whereas Bran always only walks into his direwolf, and therefore the kind of relationship is more intense and the kind of sense memory is more intense because it's always with the same person. Well, I suppose he's doing Hodor now too.
Well, I've got lots more on this Worgen stuff because I'm pretty ignorant when it comes to this. I want to hear you guys what you think.
Go for it.
So that one-eyed wolf is Faramir, right? That he fights and meets.
Yes.
Okay. So if Summer, if Bran wasn't in Summer and Summer went over there, could Faramir steal Summer?
I don't think he'd be strong enough.
I've never thought of that.
Might
yeah, he probably wouldn't be strong enough.
Because Bran is, like, one of the strongest, like, not only Greenseers, but wargs that we know of. And while Faramir is, like, pretty badass in that he can warg into multiple animals at a time, just the sheer connection between Bran and Summer, I think, is strong enough that I don't think any other warg, except maybe Bloodraven himself, could even attempt to try to break in there.
So maybe in the fight that they have, he tries to warg into him, and then that's why he submits. Because Bran even comments, like, this wolf half the size of Summer is trying to fight him, which is ridiculous. I don't know. Something to ponder on.
It's a great question.
Can't defeat the Chosen One, usually.
Of course. Bran is the Chosen One. He is Neo.
Whoa!
I know Kung Fu. I don't know where we go from there as a conversation. I think it's a mic drop and that's the end of the
episode.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty solid.
Like a lead balloon.
I'm pretty sure in the edit, Bina, you say, "Whoa, I know Kung Fu." Hard cut to the Spice Girls song. And then
and that's it. 30 minutes, we're done. Okay. More walking stuff, let's do it.
All right. Bear with me. Oh no, I already asked that one. Oh yeah, so is there a distance limit to Bran warging, or is he just that powerful he can just fucking warg anywhere? Because Bran, it says Summer is long leagues away, and it's a bit like, I thought he had to be like close to him in order to, maybe not.
I think the wall would be a limitation, no? Like, couldn't Jon not talk to ghosts through the wall?
Correct, yeah, like there was a limitation on one side of the wall, but at the same time, Arya is having wolf dreams of Nymeria in Braavos, and that's probably a lot longer distance than between Bran and Summer.
I also think the direwolves go in their own unique category, though. Like, there's a definite, like, these are your spirit animals aspect to the direwolves beyond simply like you worked into these animals once or you had a connection to them.
Yeah, so maybe it's not a thing about distance, but just within at least the context of the wall, the magical properties cutting off that, but not necessarily distance can cut off that.
Interesting.
And then I think the Weirwood network, which I hate as a term, clearly amplifies Bloodraven's ability. Like, I think he can basically be wherever he wants, even though he's north of the wall.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Bloodraven's the only one who, because he, I mean, there's a lot of theories about him doing stuff with the crows, ravens at Castle Black, and that's south of the wall.
Yeah, or just visiting Bran in his dreams. Like, that's south of the wall. He is clearly communicating with him.
And then there's also the Black Gate to consider, which we would assume has some sort of magical properties of what is able to pass through either north or south.
It can talk.
But it can't see.
Can I ask perhaps an unfair question? Do we think George actually has this whole working thing figured out, or is it just whatever he needs for the story can happen?
The latter.
I think it's the latter. I think he's making it up as he goes.
I think he has it more figured out than other stuff that he does, like distance and money and genetics.
Well, true,
like,
I think in the
grand scheme of shit that George has figured out, this is definitely on the more figured out end of the scale.
I wonder, because sometimes it just feels like, whatever works for the situation. Like, I can hand wave why can Arya sense Nymeria on the other side of the Narrow Sea because of their connection and whatnot, or is it just a story moment that he really wants to give the reader a perspective of what's happening in the Riverlands right at that moment? And, you know, if you pushed him on, it's like, does this make sense? Like, well, magic.
I think it'd probably be a combination of both, more so that, like, he'll just write it off as, like, whatever I need. But more often than not, he'll go for the like story part of it and like something that needs to happen so that you can either see or feel some way in that.
I was more just wondering like the limits of his power. Like, really, is he going to become like, I mean, if there is a Kraken that rises from the deep, is he able to like jump into that and fuck shit up in the south sort of thing?
I think I'm more curious about whether or not he's going to become something more than what Bloodraven is, or if he's just his replacement.
Yeah. Roll on wins.
Well, it's just one of those things, right? Like, is it just that Bloodraven is reaching the end of his unnaturally long life and someone needs to step in at this critical moment, or is he going to train Bran in his weird mystery cave and then send him out to do something? Like, that's kind of a big question for me about what Bran's story is.
I don't think I'll ever leave that cave, to be honest. I think
those are going to make for great chapters. People are going to love that.
Well, you see a lot of cool stuff back in time, I suppose. Maybe it will just be a spin-off story, Bran in the past. the adventures of Bran.
It'll be like Quantum Leap.
Yeah,
actually it's a lot like Quantum Leap.
Is this where we find out that's one of the TV shows that George used to work on back in the day?
You know, I put money that he did. I bet that show was on for a long time, and that's exactly the kind of stuff George would write.
Okay, I'm IMDBing him right now. How many silver stags were you putting on this bet, Stephen?
I'll buy you a beer next time you're here or I visit England.
Okay. George R. R. Martin. Talk amongst yourselves while I type.
Someone definitely just got him pissed at a bar one night and he just spouted off this idea for a show and they wrote Quantum Leap.
Okay, so let's see. Game of Thrones, Fantastic Forum, Zed Nation, Sharknado, Gay of Thrones, Robot Chicken, Golden Moustache, The Outer Limits, Doorways, Beauty and the Beast, The Twilight Zone, The Hitchhiker. That's it.
I'm sorry, did you say Gay of Thrones?
Yes.
That's what I heard.
You never seen it?
Yeah.
TV series 2014, one episode. Nominated for one Primetime Emmy, I suspect that. Parodies, the very popular show. Yeah. Do you want to send you a link?
Yeah, I guess. I'd never heard of that.
Yeah, it's just a 3-minute TV parody. So why is he credited? Probably as a writer,
did
they
appear
opinion?
On it?
Yeah, that seems really dodgy. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm loath to ask any more questions because I can sense that you guys are all sick to fuck of Bran right now.
No, not really. I mean, I just think this is like one long big tease, and there's so many of them going on right now with where we are, of people all on journeys to destinations that we know kind of what might happen, but it's just frustrating because we're not getting there with so many.
I think we've just had a long time to think about all of these adventures and stories.
And there's just so much in the Bran story arc that's still a mystery, like, and not in the fun, let's piece it together, but some of the basics. Like, whose side is Bloodraven actually on?
Yeah,
what is
exactly.
The point of Bran's training?
Exactly. Like doing like the reread like when we
don't
know
even
that.
Think it ever is clear. Like, we're here to defeat the others. The oh, okay, great.
Well, I kind of hope that's left for the reader at the end of all the stories, and you can kind of say, well, you know, ultimately he did this, but then along the way he did, you know, this, this, and this. You know, maybe the stuff with him and Euron is true, and he's the cause of all that. So you don't know. I mean, I quite like it to make my own mind up at the end and maybe leave him a bit ambiguous.
But
that's
I think
kind of how his character has been, like, not only now but kind of in the past. Like, you look at all of the stuff he did as, like, Hand of the King, and you're like, he was very successful in ensuring the Blackfyres stayed the fuck out of Westeros, but then he also fucked up a lot in regards to, like, maintaining just a stable Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah.
I sort of feel like a Bran reread's going to be a lot more fun when we know what more about Bloodraven, and therefore we can go back and see if we picked up the clues. But right now it's kind of like reading in a complete lack of knowledge is quite frustrating, or it just enhances the frustrations that have been felt over the last whatever however many years. Especially in contrast to Sam and John, which is so concrete. It's like real world political problems. This person mm-hmm. wants influence, that person wants land, and they're so tangible and understandable and relatable compared to this far more mystic stuff.
And it's with the Bran story arc too, it feels like we are maybe three chapters away from something big happening.
Exactly.
So it's like we're just perpetually waiting for the season finale for his story. So that's why like there's no pay, like, okay, we got here after a long journey. What is happening here? Okay. This is
exactly.
Yeah. So I don't disagree with you, no. I think there's definitely cool stuff going on, but without, and some of it should probably remain a mystery by the end too, but too much. It's straining the cord of my patience a little too hard.
No, definitely. I don't disagree. I'm not sitting there, you know, it's definitely not the character I'd reread, you know, from a Game of Thrones to Dance of Dragons. I wouldn't pick his chapters out.
Bloody hell. Yeah. Well, on that, like, dispirited note, let's move on to the Sam chapter.
Hooray!
Let me put you all out of your misery that I've inflicted upon you. Okie dokie. So after Bran 1, we go into Feast, where we get the Sam version of the events of February 20th. Sam is 17 years old, and we have Small Paul with the chapter summary.
All right. So, as is expected, we find Sam in the library, of course, sifting through various books and papers. He picks up a few ones he really likes and leaves and notices that people are repairing the damage from the wildling attack. He wonders about the Targaryens and if maybe they left behind a dragon egg when they were visiting the wall. But even if they did, he assumes that Stannis would have no idea how to really crack that egg. Dolorous Ed hails him from across the way and tells him that John wants to see him. And Pip and Gren are also there and just kind of tease him for missing dinner as well as archery practice. But how can he do either when there are so many great books he has down there? They also tease him about Val, who is consistently watching them from the tower. And then he moves on to go see John. Since the Lord Commander's Tower was caught on fire in the first book and Stannis is now living in the King's Tower, John has simply decided to live in Donal Noy's old quarters behind the armory. As Sam approaches, Gilly rushes out of John's quarters looking wan and frightened. Sam catches her, dropping two books as he does, and tries to talk to her, but she runs off with tears, leaving Sam perplexed. He grabs the books he dropped and finds that the former of which was undamaged, while the latter now has several muddy pages. He hates that he's ruined a book and reflects on how Gilly raises certain urges in him that a brother of the Night's Watch should not have. He enters John's room, and Lord Commander's Raven is still around and demands corn from him. When Sam gives him some from the sack by the door, the crow pecks at his hand hard enough to draw blood. John shows him a letter written by Maester Aemon addressed to King Tommen. It states that the Watch is not taking sides in the war for the throne, and only helps Stannis to defend the realms of men, and then goes on to ask for aid. John is pretty sure this isn't going to work. Sam says that Tywin may march on Stannis and destroy the Night's Watch, while John hopes that Stannis can rouse the North and still win. Stannis has sent out ravens to all the great houses of the North, asking for aid, but so far only the Karstarks have declared for him. John signs the letter and tells Sam to make sure it is sent. Sam then asks about Gilly, and then John says Val sent her to plead for Mance's life, since Stannis is planning to burn him, because Melisandre's here, and Melisandre has all the good ideas. Sam then tells John a few things he learned in the library. One, John is not the youngest Lord Commander, but that was Osric Stark, who was, I believe, 10, and he
Which
ended up
bonkers.
Serving for 6. Yeah, a 10-year-old was leading this military outfit, and he ended up serving for 60 years. John, however, points out that he was a son of a king of the North rather than a bastard of Winterfell. Sam then starts talking about what he researched about the others. For one, he realizes that the Age of Heroes might not have been that long ago, considering all the tales of things in between now and the last night. Sorry, the Long Night, tend to be historically inaccurate, most of them having knights, which didn't come over until the Andals arrived. In regards to the others, Sam talks about how the Children of the Forest would give the Watch 100 obsidian daggers every year, and that the others came when it was cold and hid from the light of the sun, emerging only at night. Some accounts speak of others riding dead animals, while others maintain that they rode on giant ice spiders. Their armor is supposed to be invulnerable against blades, and their swords are so cold that they can shatter steel. but they don't like fire and are vulnerable to obsidian. Finally, one account of the Long Night speaks of the last hero slaying another with a blade of dragon steel. John wonders if it could be Valyrian steel, but while Sam had the same thought as well, he's not certain. Sam also says there are hundreds of books to still go through and that he needs more time to find out more. But Tom says he must go to Old Town with Gilly. Mr. Aemon will accompany them as well. Sam points out that Aemon is far too old to travel, but John responds that if Melisandre needs King's blood for her spells, then Aemon is in grave danger. Darian will also join them to Eastwatch to begin life as a wandering crow. The Blackbird will take them to Braavos, where they shall arrange their own passage to Old Town. John wants Sam to become a maester, but Sam is terrified because last time he said he wanted to be a maester, his father, Lord Randall, chained him in the dungeon to see how much he enjoyed having chains around him, he spent 3 days and nights in the dungeon, as Tarleys are not supposed to be servants. He explains to John why he is unwilling to do this, but the Lord Commander does not care. He orders Sam to go and no longer call himself Craven. Sam delivers John's letter for King Tommen to Maester Aemon as instructed, and repeats his fears, but Aemon merely states that his own father had made similar objections when his grandfather, Daeron II, bundled him off to the Citadel. But Daeron knows that too many Targaryen heirs could be as dangerous as too few. Aemon believes his grandfather was right, and believes John is right to send Sam to the Citadel as well. The next day, an hour before dawn, John joins a guard of a bunch of rangers. All of them have kick-ass names like Blackjack, Kedge, Wide-Eye, and Left Hand Lou in the Lich Yard.
That's the best. Left-Hand Lou, triple L.
Left-Hand Lou. Aemon then arrives, escorted by Clytus, followed by Gilly and the baby. John arrives with Dolorous Ed to see them off, and Aemon tells John that he left him a book and made sure to bookmark a certain passage that he feels John should take a look at. Gilly, eyes red from crying, tells John that he must find a wet nurse for Dala's baby, like he promised, and not name him until he was past 2 years old. John responds that when he first saw Gilly after Ghost got into her rabbit hutch, and laments that she probably should have been more afraid of him than of his direwolf. Sam responds that Gilly has more courage than she knows, and John replies that Sam does as well. And that's the chapter.
Aww.
It's a small thing, but the Gilly thing is what stands out most to me now.
Oh, totally.
Heartbreaking.
It's just yeah. And the fact that we're getting it from Sam's point of view, and he doesn't know what's happened, and he doesn't know why Gilly's just so sad. And, yeah.
In a sense, that makes it worse, because it's her isolation with us.
Yeah, it's just... And also the fact that John kind of has, as like a leader, has to deal with this idea as well, by separating a mother from her child. And you can see that he, like, laments that he has had to do this.
Yeah, but not until the next book. So for those of us reading at the time, I don't know if any of you were... Well, you didn't know why Gilly was so upset. So we kind of were, Sam. You might have had suspicions because you knew what Melisandre was all about. But yeah, it was kind of... I don't know. Even rereading this, it's always a shock going from the last chapters of John in A Storm of Swords, which I literally just put out that episode. So I just re-listened to it. And John, who is being elected almost despite himself, like not really knowing what's going on, and is still the John we know and love from the early books. And then just seeing him here through Sam's eyes and the other night men that he calls his friends, but they're already bitching that he's distant and he's making them work hard. And he's just treating Sam so harshly in a way, with such a lack of empathy that... Even reading it today and knowing what he's going through from having read Dance, it still brings me up short. It's quite the switch.
Definitely. One of the things that really do kind of make me kind of get lost in the world of Song of Ice and Fire is just naming the books they have at the wall. Like the Annals of the Black Centaur, Jade Compendium, and this long-ass treatise, Dragonkin, being a history of House Targaryen from exile to apotheosis,
yes,
with a consideration of the life and death of dragons. If that isn't a mouthful, I don't know. You know, it's definitely like an educational like resource rather than like a top seller. It doesn't really click.
And the worst thing is, it's like between that gap, not knowing why the Jade, you know, there's obviously some message in the Jade Compendium that Aemon has left for John, and we just didn't know for another book. And it was like, oh, you know.
Yeah, at the end of the chapter, And like it would have just been so satisfying for John to like open the book and read out the passage, but we don't get that.
Nope. The other thing that always that strikes me, because today I read the chapters from episode 68 as well, which includes Brienne 3, where we get her going to Maidenpool and seeing perhaps the positive side of Lord Tarly, which is that he is trying to restore justice to his lands and get rid of all the rapers and pillagers, and he's forcing soldiers to help rebuild the town and they're starting to plant flowers again. And you also get the story about how he intervenes in that competition that some of Renly's men were running to take Brienne's maidenhead, and basically prevents her from getting raped, even though he's just a total tough guy. And I was kind of reading that chapter thinking, actually, you know what, we're not seeing him from Sam's eyes, and he's actually a good lord. He does what lords are meant to do, which is keep the peace. And okay, he's quite socially conservative, but within the bounds of that, he actually seems quite decent. And then boom, you're into Sam 1 and the chains around the neck, and just back to old man Tarly being a complete arse. And it's just amazing to me how people can be kind of good professionally, but personally or in a family context, so hurtful and harmful. He doesn't show Sam any of the, I guess, I don't know, maybe the potential rape of Brienne offended his sense of justice and order, and that's why he intervened. But he doesn't show Sam any of that courtesy.
I guess, I think, like, he's consistently embattled with things that aren't up to his standards. Like, his men having a competition to take a woman's maidenhead, I feel, is one of the reasons why he gets really pissed, but why he also blames Brienne at the same time, because this isn't up to his standards. He needs his men to be fighting men. They're here to fight battles. And then for his son Sam, his standard is, you're supposed to be my heir, you're supposed to be rough and tough like me, and you're not, so you're going to get punished for that.
Okay, so if Sam were just another person's son, he wouldn't find that offensive at all. Like, it's just that he happens to be a lord's son, and that's not, yeah.
Yeah, if Sam was Sam Flowers and was the maester assigned to Horn Hill,
he might even respect him.
I'm sure Lord Tarly would actually probably have a lot of time for him. But because he's his son and he has to institute the same leadership, judgment, and like feudal duties that he has carried out his whole life, he sees a weakness in Sam that might make it ineffective. Like, I guess the easy point of comparison is he sees Sam and he sees like a future Tywin Lannister, where the house would fall into ruin if he was to lead it.
Mm, that's a good comparison.
Yeah, I think that really makes a lot of sense.
And apparently Randall is just really good at thematic punishments, as he's like, you want to wear a chain the rest of your life? Let's put you in the dungeon for 3 days, see how you like chains then.
He secretly has a literary flair. That's where Sam got it from.
Yeah. Anyway, I found that quite provocative, going from not just linearly, but, you know, straight from one episode to the next. That really stuck with me.
I also find it really interesting in this chapter that this is kind of when it starts breaking out, that this idea of the Age of Heroes being thousands of years ago is kind of broken up by Sam going, the records don't exactly back that up. Maybe like 1,000 years ago at least, but like not like thousands and thousands.
Well, he says, though, they were written down by Septons years after.
Yeah.
So I don't think anyone knows. I think it just highlights how inaccurate all of this is.
I always thought of it as a very wry commentary on all our own sort of ancient texts, you know, like when you get to the Old Testament or whatever, that how much of this is myth and story and stuff, you know, even the New Testament stuff written 100 years after the fact.
Yeah.
Some of our histories of England, when you get to sort of the Middle Ages, again, you know, people writing on the basis of what people who knew those people told them, you know, it's really, as with all of George, it's always about, you know, it's always very meta about what stories are and how they get twisted. And I love all that in him. So clever.
I also just consistently love anything with Aemon in it, because he's just the wise old maester who, like, constantly connects us to, like, an entire different time, because he recalls when his grandfather was alive. And that was, like, basically 150 years ago with Darren II. And he's like, oh, I was bundled off to the Citadel, too, and my father didn't like it, but you know what? Tough. It's what we had to do.
Yeah.
Back in my day.
It speaks to sacrifice, doesn't it? Just doing the right thing.
And that's why I demand to see Aemon in a Duncan Ache story, even though we only got just like a remembrance.
I want to see what Aemon was like at the Citadel, or just
absolutely.
Like...
Absolutely.
As like a scrappy young maester.
Do you think he was a bit of a rogue?
I think so.
I think so.
I think I think he's similar to Egg in that he can be quite strong-willed and a bit snarky.
A little bit of a troublemaker kind of guy.
Because when we see Maesters, they tend to be like very kind of docile and respectfully, my lord, here's my advice. But when we see like Aemon talking at like Castle Black, it's not. I feel like it's not just the fact. Excuse me. Oh wow! Almost died there. It's not just the fact that he's like old and crotchety and can do whatever he wants. I feel like it's the Targaryen blood running through him that kind of gives him like. I bet when he was a young maester as well, I feel like he was a bit of a back talker to some of the people he was.
Do you think he was a bit of a smartass?
Bit fiery.
Oh, definitely.
You know, it's interesting how, like, you know, you phrase that, like, his move is about sacrifice and how he's given so much. But then he has personally given up a great deal, Maester Aemon. I haven't done all the thinking through this, but there was a time when he was offered the crown.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to think of that, like, he was an impressive man. Like, would he have been the next Jaehaerys? Like, he lived so long. Would he have been, like, a great king? And like he would have just died now if he was the king of Westeros.
And I just think that, you know, there are some people who prattle on about doing it all for the realm and, you know, Varys, e.g. And then there are people who genuinely do it for the realm, who genuinely give up power in order to calm the waters and not have civil war. So, you know, maybe he would have been a Jaehaerys and would have been this great ruler and brought stability. Or maybe getting him to be the ruler would have kicked off civil war. And right. I just kind of feel that quiet duty. I have so much respect for that relative to the, you know, Varys. I do it for the realm. Bollocks.
Right.
It's familial bloodline revenge, isn't it? I mean, let's be clear.
I mean, Aemon offers this kind of interesting parallel to Bloodraven, right? Like they kind of have not similar lives, but they've walked down maybe parallel roads.
They're both
like
from the same time period, so.
Yeah, but you know, the whole thing of, like, Bloodraven was an outcast and his family being a bastard, but, like, he dedicated his life to preserving House Targaryen, which might not have been, like, what was best for his house might not have been what was best for the kingdom of Westeros, but he was dedicated to that, and he ended up at the Wall, and he ended up, like, as part of the magical war to save Westeros, and here's Aemon, like, you know, he sacrificed and gave up personal ambition and love and everything else just to keep his family claims cleaner, and then he served his life at the Wall. Yeah, so it's interesting things there, the like echoes of characters.
He definitely comes off as like a man of, Aemon does, as a man of service. And it's oftentimes like the man of service that you would want in control. You want the person who doesn't want the crown to actually have the crown, which kind of becomes like a bit of a quandary because they don't want it. But oftentimes they're the best suited person to take on that role.
Yeah, the only person that fits rule is the person who doesn't want to.
And that would, it doesn't guarantee, like, if Aemon would have been a good king, he might have, as he was a bit more maesterly, he might have been a bit more like Aerys the First. But we don't know for sure what his reign would have been like. But it does seem like it would have avoided the whole, the Targaryens returning to brother-sister marriage and resulting in the Mad King.
So since it's quiet, I'll say I have to leave now.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us, SG Lee.
Thank you for inviting me in the 11th hour. It was fun.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was great that you could jump on.
Yeah. Have a splendid rest of the conversation. Be sure to be difficult and point out literary theories like I would.
Will do.
Have a good call, guys. Bye.
See ya.
Anything else on the Sam point of view, or should we move forward to the John one?
I was waiting for a moment, but I just wanted to say I love the Aemon Maekar comparisons. But just in kind of the same vein of what you were saying, that, you know, they had these fathers, but I think it's also, I don't know, do you think Sam could have been more like Aemon if his dad didn't beat him down so much and torture him basically as a child?
Maybe he could become that.
Do you
that?
Think
I
mean, he was always predisposed?
We're still seeing him very young. Like, he's only yet just processing what happened to him. And, you know, we're seeing Aemon now when he's old and calm and serene. But, you know, maybe, you know, in 5-10 years' time, Sam would be more over it and had some closure and had moved on and become that. But at just 17, 18, I mean, he's barely 2-3 years away from his father locking him up in chains. So,
I mean, I also feel that Maekar wasn't as, like, vindictive as Randall.
Well, I think because the king stepped in and said he's going to be a Maester, maybe he wasn't subject to the same like torture that Sam was, but.
But at the same time, we don't see, like, Maekar. I mean, he's a grumpy guy, I'll give him that, but, like, we see him very open-minded because he willingly sends Arian into exile because he's like, all right, well, this son's fucked up. While he may not have wanted Aemon to join the Knights, not the Night's Watch, the Maesters, it's the King's Decree, and Maekar's a bit like Stannis in that regard, where his duty kind of comes before that. But then Aegon, his like last remaining son, he's like, you know what? Maybe you should learn how the small folk live, and you can go with this hedge knight. So I feel like Randall would like not never in his like ever in his life give one of his sons, even a younger son, to a hedge knight to raise.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think Randall has a very set mind of how men and women should be. And men should be honourable and strong and loyal and things like that, which...
And that comes out in the Brienne chapter, right? I mean,
exactly.
That's, men are men and women are women. And, you know, if you mix that up, then you offend the laws of nature. And
and you see how he's raised the Sam's younger brother, Dickon, who I think, if memory serves me right... Yeah, I know, penis. If memory serves me right, he was the one who informed him about the whole Brienne situation. It was Dickon who found out and told Randall. So he's obviously brought his son up to be, you know, not to get involved in this shit, but to shut it down.
Which is a good thing, right? So amongst us...
Of course. You know, but I'm saying, I mean, I'm just saying that, you know, Maekar just didn't have the opportunity to torture Aemon. So I don't know, maybe he's as much of a shitbag as Randall.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. I don't really like that guy. I've been listening to the Duncan Egg audiobooks again recently and really don't like that guy.
It's so long since I've read Duncan Egg. I should probably go do that.
Oh, the audiobooks are great and they're read by Harry Lloyd. So, yeah, you know, it's like...
That's an advantage. I might do that.
We don't see his face and I know you have a soft spot for him.
Yeah, I think there's more some other girls on the podcast. I mean, I just think he's a really fantastic actor and I'm just sad that... You know, Viserys, he was so great, but unfortunately we didn't see much of him, right?
Yeah, maybe he would have been a better, like, Orane Waters or something.
I mean, I think he would have been an amazing Joffrey, as much as I really love the actor who plays Joffrey too, but...
It's too old, though, it's too old.
Maybe.
There was one thing, you mentioned those books, and I was intending on looking them up, but I didn't in the end. But the one, do you think there was the one you mentioned, the title, the extremely long one that, you know, was regarding dragons. Do you think Aemon was taking that away in order to keep it away from Melisandre? Because she's always talking about waking stone dragons. I think this is like him trying to be a little spiteful bastard. I mean, I love Aemon. He can't do anything wrong by me.
He could still be a spiteful bastard and be one of the best characters.
Oh, but it's also his own family history, isn't it? Maybe he just wants to read about it.
Well, it's going to be a long journey, I suppose.
I mean, don't you take your favourite book? I mean, you know, I take Lord of the Rings if I have a long journey, doesn't you know? Maybe that's just one of his faves.
Maybe.
That is true. I do carry, like, at least two or three books on me at all times.
Yeah, exactly. I feel very kind of weird and strange if I don't have a book somewhere about my person.
It's true.
Okay, shall we move to the John version of this chapter in that case?
Copy and paste, yes.
Yeah, we need to get into that because I just felt it was a bit lazy. Like he could have just, I don't know. Anyway, let's get into that when we get into that. Okay, yeah. After Samwell, we now get John's version of the same events in John 2. This is just two chapters after the initial Bran chapter that we read. So actually, although we're skipping books, we're not really skipping around too much in the linear timeline within Dance. John is 17 years old. It's the same day, and I believe it's Sandra with a chapter summary.
It is, and I'm actually glad you guys mentioned, like, just the rehash of it, because this was kind of a weird chapter to summarize, just because there's a rehash with not only a previous chapter, but, like, in our linear reread, Paul just did it, so I had to not cover the same things.
I know, it's tough getting second, right?
Right. But there's also a lot of exposition, which is, again, more rehashing of other chapters from both Feast and Dance. So the way I kind of summarized it was I tried to stick to the main plot points of the chapter. So if I miss anything, I do apologize for that. But regardless, so John 2, The chapter opens up with John rereading Maester Aemon's letter, thinking he cannot sign it. Relief came in the form of Dolores Ed letting him know Gilly was waiting. Lord Commander John plays his part well in convincing Gilly to care for Mansa's baby, while her own babe would stay at Castle Black under John's protection. Shortly afterwards, Sam arrives and they discuss the paper shield. John is wary it won't come across as intended. He's given Stannis food, shelter, and the night fort. Tywin would think it's too much, while Stannis says it's too little. After a short debate, John signs the paper shield begrudgingly. After Sam tells John the little new information on the others, John informs him he will be leaving for Old Town. John reflects on the never-ending stress and duty of his new position, remembering Aemon's last counsel to him. Kill the boy and let the man be born. John made his round of the castle as he did every day. He ascended the wall to have one of his men tell him how the day was. Nothing to report except the Wrong Way Rangers. The Wrong Way Rangers, John asks, are essentially just two of the Queen's men who were heading south along the King's Road as envoys for Stannis, at least John assumes. John wondered, would they even make it back, then thinks, let Stannis have his secrets, the gods know I have mine. As John fitfully went to sleep that night, having a nightmare of violently switching the babes' heads, he woke when Ed was there to let him know that it was time, the hour of the wolf. He commands Ed to send Bedwick and Janno Slynt at first light. He then meets at the column for the departure of Aemon, Sam, and Gilly and the babe. Maester Aemon tells John that he left him with a book to read, the Jade Compendium. He then tells John, knowledge is a weapon. Arm yourself well before riding into battle. John notices that it started snowing, a bad omen. As John and Sam make their goodbyes, he's reminded of the last time he saw Robb. John then tells Sam to pull up his hood because the snowflakes are melting in his hair. He then meets Bedwick in the armory to tell him they need more eyes along the wall. He's giving him command at a Way Castle in his attempt to have more manpower along the wall and its castles. Bedwick will command Icemark while he gives Grey Guard to none other than Janno Slynt. Slynt took his time to meet with the Lord Commander, acting with ill grace during their meeting. Spitting back John's command and offering insults, Slynt stormed off. The next morning, John found Slynt breaking fast with his friends. John calls out, giving him one last chance to move to Grey Guard. As Slynt continued to refuse his orders, John commands Janno Slynt to be taken to the wall and hanged. Even while being carried off, Slynt still spat insults and insolence to the boy commander. Stop, John says. I will not hang him. And then in one of the most quoted and rememberable quotes of this entire series, John says, Ed, fetch me a block. And then I wanted to end this summary with the last of this chapter, which is... John glanced back at Stannis. For an instant, their eyes met. Then the king nodded and went back inside the tower. And that is all he wrote.
It's so chilling, that final line. This is George at his best. When you get this king who is seen
it truly
and
is.
Staunch and unflinching in justice, and then this young boy who's taken this step to become that on the advice of Aemon, and this kind of subtle approval by Stannis, and you can just feel that icicle entering John's heart. Oh, it breaks my heart, and I know it has to happen, but it's so good. This is why we do the reread, right? For every Brienne chapter, this is why we do the reread. Because it just reminds you how good he is.
Absolutely.
At like sentence this, level.
This was, honestly, this is one of the best chapters of this book. And that's why it was so difficult to summarize. And one of the things that I want to point out with this, too, is in this chapter, we have John beheading a person, which we've also seen with Theon and Robb, and all three of them were raised by Eddard. The differences between all of them is when Robb beheaded Lord Karstark, it took him, I think, 2 to 3 swings to properly behead him. Mm-hmm. With Theon, it was just a hack job. He hit his head, he hit his neck, it was a mess. But then with John, we get absolutely what Eddard Stark put into these three boys that he essentially raised, you know. And I think that's just a really awesome parallel to see John totally be the son of Eddard Stark, whether that's true or not.
I agree. I think that's a brilliant observation. The thing that I found a little bit slippery, though, is when you're seeing the John POV as he kind of sentences Janos Lent, and you see the sort of alternatives he could have done, and then he's like itching for it, go on, you know, touch your steel so I can do it. And his, I do believe his reasons are for the realm, i.e. that they're for the Night's Watch, because this guy is just going to never be loyal to him, and therefore that undermines the Night's Watch. But there are like sentences where he's like, I'm not going to give you the mercy that you, I mean, you didn't give my father mercy, right? You didn't. You executed him, and I'm going to execute you. So there is a little bit of personal vengeance in there, which I think is beautifully human, but it does undermine that kind of, you know, that... Just as Eddard, I think, had this vision of himself as this perfect arbiter of justice and always doing the right thing. And I think humans are more complex. So you get all of that in this beautiful writing, too.
And that's what I think just really goes back to George's way of beautifully and perfectly writing things is, like, throughout this chapter, you get John struggling with his role as being Lord Commander. And then specifically with Slint, you get him... going back and forth like, well, he's not following my orders, so I have to punish him, so I'm going to hang him. And then he's more insolent, and he goes, you know what, I'm not going to hang him. Get me a block, I'm going to cut his head off. And it's a perfect balance of pettiness, justice, and what is actually what the Watch should do in that sort of case.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Sorry.
I would say even down to before... John beheads Slint, he asks him any last words, and then that's where Slint turns to him and tries to beg for his life, saying that he will go to Grey Guard, he will follow his command. And John thinks, he doesn't say, he just thinks, no, you've closed that door, and then swings Longclaw down.
Yeah,
it breaks my heart.
I've got two things on that. Firstly, John's using Valyrian steel, so it's going to be a cleaner cut. But secondly, maybe that's a little parallel in a crazy way to Azor Ahai in terms of the sons of Eddard Stark, and he, whether it be true or not, you know, he tempered the blade three times, and on the third time he got it right. And in this time, the third time we see it, John got it right. The third man to be brought up by Eddard Stark. I don't know. It's another thing that just came to me when you were making that excellent parallel.
Yeah, and it's really interesting too, because throughout the first three books, you're watching Robb be the epitome of what you would assume Ned Stark would be. And then you also get the person who was raised there kind of as a prisoner, trying to emulate his prison guard or whatever. But then you have the bastard son who is actually doing and preaching their mentor's ideology.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, they all try and be like Ned for different reasons. You know, Theon probably coming from quite a harsh place as a young boy and thinking, actually, you know, this makes a bit more sense up here. And Rob, because he's the heir, and then John, because it's, you know, Ned always does the right thing and has always been that guy growing up.
How do you feel about John becoming this hard person? Do you think Aemon's advice is right? I mean, at the end of this book, after all, John's going to get executed, so you could argue that by executing Slint, he's setting his own destiny. There are costs to this stuff, right? So... could there have been another way for him to rule that was more conciliatory?
I honestly think exactly what he's been doing in this position is absolutely necessary. What's happened, or what is supposed to happen, including Aemon's advice to him about killing the boy, which literally happens at the end of this specific book. So the boy will be killed and the man will be reborn.
Yeah. It's a tough one, though, because you can just sort of so see where it's going to lead to. And it just puts him in such a vulnerable position. You know, sending Sam away, while totally the right thing to do, just leaves him without his linchpin and someone that he needs. And it's analogous. I know that it's not truly analogous because he still has his direwolf with him, but it's analogous to Rob going into the Red Wedding and locking up his or allowing his direwolf not to enter the hall. I just feel that Sam provides, he's kind of like an amulet. He provides a degree of awareness and protection for John. He's a complementary skill set, the tactical skill. This chapter breaks my heart because you just see John do kind of what Jamie will do in Feast later, which is, you know, blackmail someone over potentially killing their kid. He does that to Edmure. And he just does all the stuff that you know is so contrary to his true inner nature. And you know he has to do it. So it's kind of like with Aemon, you see the ultimate result of that, of allowing yourself to become a servant to the Night's Watch. And then John, you see the becoming, like the true emotional toll of doing it. And it's like he can't sleep, he's having bad dreams. It's devastating.
And I think it's the same way that, like, everything he is doing, he believes to be for the greater good. So sending off Sam, sending off Aemon, even not spending time with his friends at the wall, whether they're, you know, eating at the dinner hall or, you know, anything like that, he's making a very big sacrifice that absolutely adds to what ends up happening to him.
Yeah. Start sending away his allies.
Exactly.
And all of that's because it's a time of war. If he'd have been elected in a time of peace, he would have had time to just still be mates and to sort of gradually ease into that Lord Commander role, and not for it not to be such a shock to his friends, you know, find him condescending. But in war, there's no time for that.
Well, I mean, even in this chapter, it's the first chapter we see him as Lord Commander, and he's, aside from Sam's, but in his own POV, and he's just trying to do too much too fast. And, you know, with already stretched and scarce resources, you know, he's trying to rebuild the stairs and he's sending people off to Icemark and Greyguard. And, you know, when you have such little manpower, you kind of need to focus on a smaller amount of tasks and get those done and move on. And, you know, I mean, again, it's probably because of his age and inexperience in command. I mean, he's been trained in it, but he's not had to juggle so many different things all at once. He's maybe seen these decisions and he's trying to achieve everything all at once. I don't know. It's as you say, it's sad because, you know, we all know what happens down the line.
Absolutely. Mm. So, like, in terms of like how this chapter comes into being, I kind of tend to believe, I don't know, actually, there's probably interviews about this. I suspect that George wrote this chapter first and then went back and reworked it for the Feast separation chapter. I don't know. I find it a little bit weird that he does give us literally entire paragraphs that are exactly the same.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than, I mean, you didn't have to do the dialogue the second time. You could have just more given impressions, you know. John then called in Sam and was, you know, it broke his heart to sort of send his, you know, best mate off. But he was shocked at his reaction and thought he'd prefer to be away from the fighting. And but at the end of the day, was frustrated and wanted him to man up and, you know, become the boy, you know, suppress the boy inside. You could have done a lot of the kind of the bits that are different, which are the reaction shots, then have all the dialogue in there. Unless maybe the publisher said, look, it's been so long, you may as well whack it back in again.
Well, I would have said the contrary, because Sam's chapter ends way before this chapter does in terms of the timeline.
Oh, yeah. This one kind of envelopes it, right? It has John calling Sam in and then sort of carries on after, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Just then, it's funny, actually, that you say that, because John does, I mean, he's, you know, he's saying all of the harsh things that Sam needs to hear in order to get him to fuck off. But but in his mind, exactly as you say, he's like, you know, why wouldn't you like this? And, you know, and then he's like, well, you should be brave. You know, but actually in his mind, he's thinking Sam's scared. He's going to go off to the wall. I just thought that is quite interesting, that contrary.
But it is weird reading them side by side, because I just did end up skipping it, basically.
Yeah, I definitely kind of half skimmed the first couple pages of John's chapter, because it really was almost verbatim of Sam's, at least their meeting.
Yeah, because I actually started doing a side by side just to see, is it literally the same? Yes, it is. Oh my
god. One of the positives I will take away, and it kind of goes to what you're saying, Dina, is like maybe he could have just done like impressions or from the thought of, rather than just rehashing things we've already read, is the way when they're saying goodbye and John is thinking to himself, you know, like, oh, then it started to snow, that's a bad omen, and then he's talking to Sam and they're saying their goodbyes, and then he goes, also pull up your hood because the snowflakes are melting. Like, that is, that's some of the best ways to write that sort of interaction that you've already had in a previous chapter, because it gives you their thoughts, but it's not like, oh, yeah, last time I saw Rob, snowflakes were melting in his hair. Then he died, and then I don't know, so I'm seeing him now, and snowflakes are melting in hairs. He might die. I might not see him. It's more of a poetic, like, the way us as humans naturally romanticize things is, like, he sees the snowflakes melting in Sam's hair, so he says, put up your hood in a concerned way because snowflakes are melting in your hair. So it something like that, to me, it punches you a lot harder in the heart than the first half of this chapter, where the Sam and John interaction was almost the same minus a few things.
Yeah,
couldn't agree more.
Maybe it's Sam seeing John with snowflakes in his hair and he's never gonna come back.
No, they're gonna be reunited. Come on.
Do you think they will, though? That's actually what I wanted to ask. Do you think they're gonna be reunited or not? Because I personally don't. I think Sam's story ends in the South.
What do you think he's going to do? How does it end for Sam?
Yeah, that was a question I had.
That's a lot more.
Well, I mean, as in, do you, all right, put it simply, do you think Sam will ever return to the wall?
Not in the story proper, but maybe in an epilogue sort of sense, like years after the event of the books, he will, but I don't think he will end up back there in this series.
So yeah, maybe they never will meet again then.
I tell you why I think they'll meet, just because I think it would be narratively satisfying to have them meet, even if it's in what remains of King's Landing, even if it's 5 years later, or even if they've both been through huge tests of courage and changed maybe unalterably in the meantime. It just feels like there are some things that I think don't need to have a resolution. Like, I don't think the Hound needs to come back. I don't need to know who Coltans is. I don't need to see Benjen. I somehow feel that Sam and John, who started together, must end together in some way. Just as I feel that Arya must at some point see one of her Stark siblings again in some manner. It just, I don't know why. There's no evidence. It just feels like emotionally, narratively, it would be bizarre if that didn't occur.
Well, I think if Sam meets him again, it will be a Lady Stoneheart situation where he's very, very different.
See, and that's why I'm afraid that it would happen, because I wouldn't want to see that. I'd more so kind of the aspect.
Sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. You go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think for Sam's story, it would be more of a full circle if he met his father again and got maybe not won over on him, but just kind of held his own.
Agreed.
I think that's more for Sam's arc. What would be for me more literarily pleasing.
See, and I feel like the best resolution, keeping Sam south and John at least mostly north and neck, a good way to have a resolution to their story would kind of almost be like these two chapters, where they have the same, like, almost verbatim dialogue. But more so, like, Sam and John in the North and South think about each other the same exact way at the end of the war. So, like, in a parallel sense, they have the same interaction, but it's more internal thoughts about the other. I think that would, to me, be more satisfying, so that they could still accomplish whatever they need to do and where they're at.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I don't know. I can't imagine Jon Snow going south of the neck, to be honest. I don't know.
I feel like he may not even go south of Winterfell if he even goes that far south.
Well, I think he has to go to Winterfell again. But yeah, I'm with you on that one. You know, his story has been not just physically, but you know, everything he knows or wants or thinks about is the North. You know, I mean, aside from his siblings who are all over the place, I just can't, you know, I think he's more a point that everyone's going to come back to as opposed to him going somewhere.
No, I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah, you know, whenever his siblings think about him, he's always Jon Snow at the wall, and usually it's like a safe place or a place that, you know, is fine. We can just go there and it'll be okay. But I think, yeah, he's always going to remain in the North. Who knows? He might die on Pike. Fuck knows. Again.
God. I need a new book. This is how I end so many episodes.
I know. I've been listening to all of the recent reread and they all end this way. Someone, usually Varley, always says, we need a fucking book.
While blinking his eyes. Yeah, I don't know. It's just...
Well, we need a book that isn't an anthology piece. I mean...
Well, Xander, we lost you.
Ooh, what? At what part?
You're back. He said, we need another book. That's not an anthology.
Yeah, I was saying at least a Duncan Egg novella.
Yeah, something, I know, man.
Something more solidified than just like, oh, this maester said this and these historians wrote this down. Like, as great as they are for world building, they're not satisfying our hunger.
I know. I feel like a crackhead on the corner or something in the wire. Just like, gotta get me some Song of Ice and Fire, man. Gotta get me some of that. I did enjoy the recent Maegor story though, but it didn't hit the spot.
I mean, I love me some Duncan Egg, but I want a proper actual narrative book now.
Well, I mean, that's our number one hope, but
I know, a man can dream.
I'm done with all the other stuff that appeases me and keeps me hanging on, in the words of Debbie Harry. I don't know.
The Maegor stuff was interesting. It was cool.
It's just when you read, and then again, I don't want it rushed because I want George to write like he writes here. And in a sense, it proves, doesn't it, that at his best, even in Feast Dance or Dance in particular, that people get really annoyed with. I mean, that John chapter is an absolute classic.
Yeah, but that came in his fifth book. So I'm not at all worried that when the next book comes out, it's going to be lacking quality.
Exactly. I just want his words. I want his sentences.
Of course.
I want the way he ends that chapter. John looking at Stannis, that mutual recognition, punch in the stomach. That's what I want.
Sorry.
Oh, go for it, man.
I was just going to say that's such an epic bro moment.
It really is.
And that's so good, that's why I had to quote it.
Yeah,
I'm so glad you did.
Yeah, it was the moment of this reread. It really was. There's not much more to say. I mean, this is just a classic chapter. It's John going from boy to man, taking the tough decisions. It's becoming boy to man in a way that Rob never really did. And
yeah, you almost wish that you had Rob's POV just to see, because I would have loved the, you know, like John and Aemon, the Blackfish Rob would have been, they would have had some amazing conversations.
Yes.
Holy shit, that would be the best.
I know, and I just feel a bit like, you know, we get fucking Bran, but we don't get Rob.
But then again, I do feel that having Rob off screen is one of the most audacious sort of narrative choices that he makes, that George makes. I mean, I love it, because again, it comes back to, you know, everything that Sam's saying about, well, there's these books and those books, and I can only find this many records of actual Lord Commanders, and that's the whole thing about Rob, you know, what can you believe? And even here, like, so many people are prisoners of false knowledge, like John believing his brothers are dead and Sam knowing they're not, but not being able to tell him. And it's, you know, Brienne and Black Brienne 3 chapter, thinking, well, shouldn't bother going to the Eyrie now, because why on earth would Sansa go there when her aunt's dead? And all these assumptions people make. And then there's that one line that Melisandre has where she talks about prophecy, and she at least has the self-awareness to say, you know, I know that sometimes, you know, the prophecy comes from the Red God, but I'm just human and I might misinterpret it. I'm like, well, you know what? Kudos to you for actually admitting that. That there's some interpretation and you can get it wrong. Okay. Anything else to say on these three? We're dropping like flies, mate. It's like John Luke peeling off his friends and losing them. So we lost SJD to work, and we lost Small Paul to an uncooperative roommate. So.
AKA Drift, Icemark, and Grey Guard.
Exactly. We
sent them away.
Pretty much.
But have you all got anything else to say on these chapters, or should I close it out?
I think the only thing we didn't comment about on the John chapter is all of us cheering for Jano Slynt getting what he deserves. That's probably the only thing we didn't comment on.
Oh, mate, we were saving that for a little power knee slide at the end.
I tell you why it's not a total power knee slide for me is, as much as I want him to die and I want him to be killed in a mood of revenge by Stark, it's because you see what it's doing to John. It's making him this battle-hardened, you know, quasi Stannis. So that kind of takes the edge off for me. Yeah, exactly.
No, it's kill the boy.
Oh.
It's It's I don't see it as that at all. I see the respect from Stannis as basically you killed the boy.
Oh no, I respect John for doing it. I mean, I totally respect him for doing it, and it's the right thing to do on so many levels. It's just it can be the right thing to do and still start sad to have to see it done.
Yeah. But I mean, he was, you know, for me, that guy, Mr. Frog Jowls, or however George always describes him, he's such a bastard.
And it's a great example of George taking a character who's actually quite minor in the early books.
Yeah.
And is just there to prove in a way that Tyrion's really clever and can figure out who's kind of against him and who's, you know, who's gossiping and sort of leaking out information. And then he goes on to do more and more horrible things and get more and more elevated to positions of power. And it's just, yeah, he's just been this growing malevolent figure that started off as a bit of a figure of fun and this minor idiot. And finally he gets his comeuppance. Oh, by the way, Alistair Thorne. Was there a moment when Alistair Thorne would have gone against John?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think this was a test.
And but why does he not? Why does he then decide not to?
Well, I was literally just about to say that he... Alistair, I forget on a reread, and this chapter highlights it perfectly, that Alistair Thorne is a crony of Janos Slynt. And it's usually because Alistair Thorne, maybe no spoilers, but the show kind of influences that a little bit, that it's like you always think of Alistair Thorne as like John's massive rival at the wall, or at least I do anyway. And
because he's treating him like crony. Shit from the very first moment.
Well, yeah,
I mean, way before Daniel Slynt turns up, he's giving John a hard time.
But he sucks up to him so much, and it's actually Janos Slynt who, you know, Alistair Thorne doesn't put his name forward in the choosing. It's Janos Slynt, and he's the one who's trying to round up support for him. But maybe it's Alistair Thorne being a bit savvy and, you know, thinking this is a bit of a dangerous move. I'd rather, you know... I mean, not that the Night's Watch is like this, but I'd rather be Hand of the King than the King, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting to see that. And then maybe in this instance, he was testing and, you know, he was testing John as Lord Commander. Maybe he whispered in Janos Slynt's ear and I don't know. But it's cool, you know, it's interesting to think that, you know, maybe Alistair Thorne was the puppet master.
What's your thinking, Xander, on Alistair Thorne?
I kind of, similar to how Noah was just kind of explaining it, I kind of see him more as, like, testing John as Lord Commander. Like, he was always a prick to him, but once he got elected, he kind of wanted to see what he would do. But this act, executing Janos Slynt to Alistair Thorne was like, okay, he is the man that can do what needs to be done in this harsh environment or harsh times or... something like that. So even if he did get begrudging respect for him, I think after that moment he started to respect John more as Lord Commander.
Yeah, I have time for both of them. Yeah, I think you guys are right.
Yeah, I thought about this a little bit actually. He gets sent to the wall in Robert's Rebellion, doesn't he? Alistair Thorne.
Yep.
He's a Targaryen loyalist. So I mean, I guess that's where he was. What? Sorry.
He has form.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, he's obviously got good reason to hate Ned. I'd love to see in, like, a Robert's Rebellion Duncan Egg-style mini-series that Ned, like, basically stripping him of all his lands and titles and sending him north.
I tell you what, Alistair Thorne would make quite a fun epilogue or prologue.
Yeah, if he's still alive.
True. It's like I don't need him to be a POV character, but just, like, one chapter just seeing into his grubby little mind might have been quite interesting. Like, if we're going to get, like, Aris Oakheart, like, you know, one chapter POVs that might have been more interesting, I think that would be one of them.
Yeah. I'm a little disappointed that he's not going to write any more POVs.
Yeah. I mean, he says stuff and then he does stuff, so. Awesome balls. Okay, so... thank you all for joining, including Stephen and Paul, who had to leave early. For those of you following along at home, next episode of The Reread is going to be hosted by Adam, aka Drowned Snow from the forums. It's going to cover Reek 1, which is awesome, John 3 from A Dance with Dragons, and Davos 1 from A Feast for Crows. So for all of you massive Davos fans out there, of whom I know there are many, do tune in for that. You can follow You can follow us by searching for Vassals of Kingsgrave or VOK Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, iTunes, WordPress. I just quit Facebook, by the way. And if you want to get
it. Did you?
Yeah. 2 weeks to you. I did it actually shortly after Chicago, although unrelated. To get involved, you can search for a podcast device in Fire and join the forums. Any forthcoming episodes, guys, that you're on?
This is the first podcast I've been on in months. So.
I know. I'm going to change that. Start harassing you on Skype, though, man, because it was fun. Thank you guys so much for joining. And I mean, Noah, we need to meet again soon. Xander, it was such a pleasure meeting you in Chicago.
I had a blast.
Thank you for being on. Cool.
Thank you for hosting.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Anyone read any good books? Are you gonna edit this out?
Might put it at the end. I just finished Ready Player One, which I really enjoyed. And everyone was telling me, oh, it really sucks, but I really, really loved it. And I'm not really a gamer. I suppose I'm nostalgic for the 80s a little bit, but I just thought it was a really gripping read. I kind of like read it like way later than I should have done because I literally couldn't put it down. And yeah, love the film, love the book. They're quite different though. Gonna vok about it on the weekend if anyone wants to join.
Oh, I've not seen it.
I've not read nor seen.
Me either, but I might go see it soon.
Okay. Well, if you do, I can hold off for a couple of weeks, actually, until more people see it too.
Is the film worth it? I mean, like, spoilers for the podcast on the weekend, but is it worth it?
I think it's just a good Spielberg, kind of old-fashioned Spielberg, you know, proper children's action movie that's really gripping and visually spectacular. And if you do like lots of 80s stuff, then there's lots of great references to it. So I had a bunch of fun. I think the book's also very similar. It's one of those kind of adventure stories that you really want to know what happens next. I think the book's probably more socially gritty because Spielberg always schmaltz his stuff up a little bit. But I had a bunch of fun. I had very limited knowledge or expectations, though, but I really enjoyed it. I'd recommend it.
I will check it out. I'm rereading the Accursed King series because I fucking love it so much.
Who's that by?
Maurice Druon.
Never heard of it. What? Tell me about it.
Well, it was like, like George R. R. Martin recommends it, and it was one of those, and I just was like, okay, let's give it a go. It's like fictional, historical fiction.
Did he take like a lot of influence from those book series?
Yeah, I mean, you can see it. There's no obvious, you know, he's not stealing it word for word, but
no, not like stealing storylines, but yeah.
You see, yeah, there's definite elements. I mean, the first book's called The Iron King, and you can see a lot of kind of Tywin in that. In that character, and then it's a really good read. It's very interesting, and I'm a big history buff, so I love it. Although the final book, no spoilers, but it's written by like a monk who's traveling around the country, and I couldn't finish it. But the other six are great.
Cool, good rec. Anyone else with a book recommendation while we're doing the book club aftershave?
Nope, guess not.
Just Mortal Engines. That's Mortal Engines. All I'd recommend.
Cool. In fact, what I realized is that there was a book club episode ages ago on Ready Player One that I have to now go back and listen to. So the glories of Vok, back in the 180s, I think. The mists of Vok time. 'Cause I know, do you want to do some mandatory football chat?
Yeah. Well, let me get the pleasantries out of the way. Thank you, Bina, for hosting, and thank you for bringing me in.
Welcome.
And all right, let's get into this. Xander, Xander, where do you stand on the old Arsenal-Tottenham debate, mate?
I will decide after the 2-U debate.
Well, let me give you the facts, Xander.
Yeah, the facts. I'm raising my fingers in the air.
Spurs are currently facts, the better mate. Team. We're higher in the league. We're the genuine North London club insofar as we come from actually North London. And we have a great, glorious history of just being, you know, just a really nice team to support. And we're doing really well this season.
Arsenal
are actually from South London, the Woolwich Arsenal, and because they're 150 years scum, ago, they somehow wiggled their way into the North London League.
150 years ago, and they succeed
by playing really boring football. They were so boring this weekend that their own fans were booing them off at half time. But they did what they always do, which is play really uninspiring, boring football for like 75 minutes, and then just, you know, score some jammy goals at the end because they've just ground everyone into boredom and attrition.
Do you want to talk about diving when you've got Mr. King Diver? Dele Alli, literally, he's...
Just jealous because he's not winning anything. The only way they were so bad last year, Sander, that they didn't even get to play in the proper European Champions League, and they're playing in the secondary version. But they're so jammy they're probably going to win it, and by winning it they might actually kick us out of our rightful place of being in it.
No, we actually can't because Chelsea are knocked out.
Oh, okay, well that's good.
So we could meet you next season, but I was praying for you to finish fourth, Chelsea to win the Champions League, and us to win the Europa League.
Yeah, well, as was my boyfriend, he's an Arsenal fan. So there you go. You can either side with the person who, you know, supports an actual North London club, not a wannabe aspirant Blackfire style, you know, usurper.
Blackfire style. How dare you?
It's the blues and the red, isn't it?
Blackfire.
How dare you?
And that is your surname on the forums, I realise.
How very dare you? Actually, it is. Yeah, Xander, you're on my side.
Yeah, I'm going to have to side with Noah on this one just because.
Jesus Christ. I buy the guy lunch and this is how he repays me. What can he do?
You dug your own grave there, Beanie.
The youth of today. Just can't do anything with him. Okay, what can I say?
You can't say much because you haven't won a trophy in about 7 years.
Yeah, but all you win is like the Milk Cup.
We win the FA Cup, the premier trophy in Britain.
Anyone can win a knockout cup, mate. Anyone.
What, 3 times in 4 years?
Do you think Arsene Wenger's going to get sacked at the end of the season?
Oh, I fucking hope so.
Yeah. But you have to admit, you are one of the few clubs where, like, routinely you boo off your own team because they're so boring. Whereas at least Spurs fans enjoy watching their own team.
Yeah, it's because you've probably spent most of your adult life supporting a team that are more boring than a brand chapter.
That's not true. That's harsh, man. That's below the belt.